question is regarding what you were sharing about being able to actually kind of remain in your tribe, but also be free of the constraints that the tribe or may put on you, or the world may place on you as well. My question is it sometimes appropriate to completely leave the tribe?
Kind of like the breath and using that as a pause button. But I just think about like everyday life and kind of how hectic it is. Like, and even when maybe you don't necessarily like have the time to do that, have you developed or like, do you recommend like any specific like daily, weekly, or regularly things that have helped you be able to do that? Because I even think about like where at work it's very busy and hectic and like different people and a lot of like I deal with a lot of trauma, so like because I work in a social services place, so it just can be a lot piled on constantly. So I was wondering if you have any recommendations or things that help you be able to kind of every day in the moment just not become so easily overwhelmed with just like a plethora of stuff.
I'm gonna speak for myself, but maybe other folks also feel this. Really pay attention to what Marisol was saying about what happens to the depletion of our resources, you know, our energy resources, when it all goes in a direction, particularly if I identify with the pain, fill in a different word for pain. And I was wondering if either of you had, things that could help to me and other folks who have a particularly hard time dealing with like immediate family members, or anyone you consider an immediate family member who may feel very toxic to you. But I guess, and not to make it sound like pathologizing, but for us who are trying to awaken to this path and interact maybe with people very close to us, we're very empowered to be not kind. So I'm just trying to figure out how to have those kinds of conversations.
So I guess also based on what Marisela said, how do we reach, like, find that break point between holding our anger and honoring it on the one hand and not sort of wallowing in it and being able to pull ourselves up and respond effectively and not get burned out, but not denying that it's happening, being patient with ourselves, watching it arise as well.
Maybe one more question, and we'll share. Okay, two. So, Natalie and then Rhonda.
So, as I was listening to Marisela speak about, the pain and the reacting, the pain, and like neuroscience, it tells you your brain, it's there to protect you. So you only have to put your finger in the flame one time. Then you know not to do that again. So when your brain experiences something for the second time, it's saying it's already down the path, of responding.
Mm-hmm.
And you only, so you don't really have choice in that second because your brain has already left the station.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if what you're saying is that mindfulness will break that up, because generally it has your, it has to occur to you differently,
mm-hmm.
to make a different choice. Other than that, it's already left the station. So I'm just wondering where in that space, do you have it occur to your brain differently so you're in a place of choice?
So my question is, we are talking a lot about an important use, so people of color in relationship to white supremacist society, and other isms that oppress us in our multiple identities. How do we also bring this internally, not just internally to ourselves as individuals, but within the people of color
mm-hmm.
community? Because some of that trauma and some of that, those isms are, play themselves out in our community.
Thank you. Could I ask you just to say a specific example, just so we're, I hear there's a lot of resonance in the room with just what you said, but in answering it, it's, if there's something concrete.
A specific example would be people of color who find themselves good on race, you know, but not so good on sexuality
mm-hmm.
or gender.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Thank you.
One other example would be being in a people of color moment together.
Yes. Yes.
And I think part of this goes back to what both of you talked about, but in some ways reacting with the same kinds of responses of protecting oneself and therefore reacting to someone else
mm-hmm.
out of the space of conscious or unconscious negativity and distance.
Yeah.
And you don't even know why.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's just replaying itself. So it's that both and.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, you probably aren't going to have a
break.
We'll have a break, but we'll just start Dharma sharing later because it's 11:45. But.
It's not a question. I just know that I addressed it to you, Marcella, but I would love like both of you to answer. Maybe you don't have a specific one, but I didn't mean it for only you.
Yeah. I think most of the questions are about practice.
Yeah.
Okay.
So to, I'll start and to Jade's question about how to maintain awareness of breath and a sense of being centered and solid in the midst of a lot of trauma and hectic, you know, overwhelming circumstances. I see this in two ways. So one is if our systems are strong and healthy enough and have enough support to keep us balanced in such a situation. So that's one part I'll answer to. And then another part is if it's so overwhelming to our system, that it's really not healthy for us to be in that environment. Because we're like just barely keeping our head above water. So it's like, first of all, just knowing which of those situations is more descriptive of our experience. Okay. So, and of course there's ways to build and to grow the supports we need to be in that kind of environment. And Sangha, spiritual community, is the key. Having people that can support you to practice, to stay centered, can be a huge sense of protection that keeps the tenderness of your heart held, so that you can continue to be full of compassion for the suffering around you. And if you don't have, it's like, a cell has several layers of membrane around it to be healthy. And so we, as humans, we need enough protection and somewhere soft to land so that we can be in the face of the kind of difficulty that we may have to work in. And so Sangha can be people. Are you in Baltimore, Jade?
No, I'm in D.C.
In D.C., okay. So there are lots of groups that practice mindfulness and meditation in D.C., and there's a POC group in D.C. There's a LGBTQ, just in case anyone wants to know about the LGBTQ queer Sangha in D.C. So there are dedicated spaces for practice specific to at least some of our identities that are here in this community. But Sangha can also be Rock Creek Park or pets or a particular tree that we take refuge in. So every day we need to be nourishing the good, wholesome qualities in us. So one of the things I invite people to do is to make a list of all the things you know that bring you joy. Like swinging on a swing, or going swimming, or going dancing, or writing a letter, or taking a nap. And you make a list and you put it where you see it every day, on your fridge, on your mirror, and you check to do one of those things each day. So one thing is we can nourish ourselves and we can make contact with things that nourish us on a regular basis, whether it's friendships, whether it's a community of practice, whether it's other kinds of beings that can nourish us and keep our energy fresh. So that, if we have a lot of, if we're in touch with joy, if we're in touch with things that inspire us, we can handle suffering without getting overwhelmed by it. And we can come to it with freshness, with a sense of, let me be here, let me hold what needs to be held. But if we're depleted, like Marcella was sharing, then when we encounter suffering, we can't do anything about it because it just overwhelms us. And there are situations that are simply so overwhelming that it really may not be compassionate to ourselves to ask ourselves to try to hold space there. Mm-hmm. Like people who are humanitarian workers in situations of war, for instance. If they're so overwhelmed, it may be that, there's a time for everything, that you put in a year and then you take a break. So it may be just gauging, like, okay, I've been working in this situation of high stress, of high intensity, the ER room. People don't do that for like 10 years at a time and live very well, So you may just need to gauge, like, okay, I can do this for a few months and then I need to take something less intense and then I can get back in the game and then I can take a break, So part of it is also just seeing how much support do I need to do this? And how long can I do it for before it's not healthy anymore? And one of my kind of the ways I really check in and gauge whether something's helpful for me to keep doing is if I really am not enjoying it anymore. Like, I used to lead a family retreat every year in Italy when I was living in Germany, and like after the fifth summer, I got there and I was like, I feel terrible. I was like, this is not fun anymore. I'm in a bad mood. I was like, all right, this is the key that it's time to, you know. So it was a lot of energy to run that camp, basically, for parents and children. And it's like, no, I'm done with this. This wasn't, you know, bringing me joy or energy anymore. So that was, I listened to that. So that's a way to gauge. It's like if you show up at work every day and you're already pissed because you have to be there, you know. So just on this balancing of nourishing joy so that we can hold suffering. I don't know if, did you all play with Weeble Wobbles when you were little?
Mm-hmm.
Those little egg-shaped things, you push them over and they come back upright because they have some weight at the bottom. I always think of that image, that if we're nourishing ourselves regularly, then even if something really heavy comes along and pushes us over, we can come back up and center ourselves again, you know.
Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down.
Thank you. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down.
So I'd like to look at your question, Rashid. Is it sometimes appropriate to completely leave the tribe? So my initial thought on that is there is no black and white. It's not like that. It's not as dualistic as I've left now and now I'm over here. So just to hold that in the bigger context of things. And then when I was preparing to talk this morning, I did think about that, actually, going from individual to into tribe. You know, we're born and then we immediately go into tribe or community, and then at some point in our development we start looking for our independence, and we try to figure out who we are and try to dislodge some of the teachings we receive from our parents and so forth. And then we find our own tribe or community. And I think this practice of going inside ourselves it's not leaving tribe, but it's a way of looking beyond tribe for who we are, or to understand who we are. So it's sort of like when we shared about eating in silence, that we're not speaking to each other in that moment, because we're really going in and we're noticing in our mouth and we're thinking about the food. And so in a way that's leaving tribe, right? Because we've now disengaged from this community that we usually engage in, and doing a thing that we would usually do with that community, which is to talk while we're eating. So I often think of that when I'm with friends. There are friends I can be quiet with, and there are friends that I can't. And then when I try to be quiet with the friends that I can't be quiet with, they think I've left them, that I've done something, they've done something that I don't want to be around them anymore. And I have to insist that, you know, my usual thing is not about you, it's about me. And so there's a way that in our practice, we leave. So the question for me is broader. For me, the way I think about it is there's a way that in my family, for instance, when I go to visit my family, I'm there in my tribe, in that tribe, and yet there are things I do that I'm not in tribe. Like every morning I go to the park and meditate. And I had to really establish and make that practice clear. And it took a while for my mom not to be hurt that I didn't want to be there. I came home, why wouldn't I want to be there? And then in the evening I go to the park again to exercise. Those are, for me, leaving tribe, because my mom is not, now she's come to expect it. But it was hard initially, because I go home for 4 or 5 days and I'm away by myself in a park, either meditating or walking or jogging for maybe 3.5, 4 hours. And if things are crazy in the house, it could be longer. like the last 2 times I've been home. That's leaving tribe too, because it's a way where that tribe is important for me. You know, it's my family, I love them. And yet I need to take care of myself. I need to go inside. And it's part of the same response of what Karjo was sharing, is that we start to know what we need. And I know when I don't do that, I can become very impatient and inattentive. I can see my responsiveness when I'm, and especially, you know, when we go home, that's when we know where our practice is, right? Is when we go home. And then there is a leaving of tribe too, like completely. So for me, you know, I do a lot of activist work in Baltimore. I've been doing it for more than 25 years. Very connected in community. And I left in 2006 to live in the monastery in France for a year. Everything went into storage. I quit my job. People gave me a compass to say, can you really come back? Are you gonna come back? And I said, yeah, I'll come back in a year. And then it was like 3.5 years later that I went back. You know, I was in Plum Village for a year, and I went to Blue Cliff for a year and a half, and then I spent like almost a year in solitude in different places. I left tribe. I didn't communicate by email, by phone, my best friends, I left. I was not in an intimate relationship. The only person I communicated with was my mother. And that was really hard for her. And I came back to the States and made changes in what I was planning to do because of my mother, because she became ill. So I did that real, you know, so I'm talking about it like you never leave, but I'm also, you know, there's the different layers and the gradients of what we might understand leaving tribe to be. And I think for us, it's the sitting with self in some stillness and some spaciousness, and maybe with others that we trust in that space, to help us maybe understand, you know, what's the level of leaving. You know, the leaving might be a solo retreat for 10 days or something like that. Or it might be that you don't see certain people because they're not contributing to our practice right now. You know, when I came back, it was hard because we leave, but everyone else stayed. I mean, it's kind of like family. I've always left. I left when I was 17. But I always go back. And going back into tribe, for me, is practice. And it's a claiming my own, because coming back with what has been revealed is a way of bringing that back to share with tribe again. So I think the going back, our going back is so critical and important, because even though like my family don't understand me often, there's a way they see that I'm more calm. Like I asked my mom when I went back, and I said. And she was not happy with my leaving. And I said, well, isn't there something that you're happy about? She said, yeah, you're not as angry. I'm like, that's huge. Because I had the world on my shoulder and I was going to change it all by myself. With my peeps, of course. But so I think there's a way that the leaving I almost feel leaving is necessary, you know. Sometimes I think leaving is necessary. It's just how do we do it in a graceful and a skillful way that we don't harm too much. And some people will be harmed, but we have to know that maybe we can't take care of that. And it's the how we leave is the intention. I'm leaving for myself so that I can take better care and be better with my family. You know, that was part of it for me. When I left the community and the organizing, it was, I'm leaving because I am so angry right now, it's very dangerous for me to be here. And I don't want to be as angry as some of the other activists that I'm seeing and the things they're saying and doing. And if I stay, I'm going to go right there. So right now I'm leaving so that I can get straight, and I'm going to bring that back and share that. So there's this intention that we carry when we're leaving. It's the healing ourselves and the world that, so the leaving is kind of amorphous. I hope it helped answer your question.
Let's do one more each. I'm happy to do Anthony and Custodian. You can do Natalie and Rhonda, Tyler, POC, something like that.
Okay.
As much as we can. So I'm going to try to address Anthony and Kasturi's question and also just throw out a practice that I think addresses a lot of the questions mm-hmm. and I think is helpful for all of us. But you mentioned how to breathe in the midst of so much busyness. There's a story of Eckhart Tolle, this spiritual teacher, of him, his student comes to him and shows him this prospectus of a retreat center with all these lovely retreats, and he says, even if you went to all of those retreats, it wouldn't be as beneficial as having many moments of stopping throughout the day. So however many retreats you go on, they're not as beneficial as integrating small moments of stopping into your daily life, right in the midst of your activity. That you don't have to go away and leave your life in order to calm your mind. I mean, there are times when that's really important and really helpful, but you can have little speed bumps throughout the day, little stop signs, and those accumulate. And that changes our habit, deeply held habits of running constantly, of being always, you know? And that's a deeper capacity for transformation comes through that, building it into your daily life, because you're not gonna be on retreat all the time. This is a very artificial environment, you know? But if, when you wake up, that's why we put the gathas everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we hope you'll buy some and take some home with you and put them up at home. Not trying to make an advertisement there, but they are a practice tool. We want you to use them. When you wake up in the morning, there's one you can put by your bed. As soon as you wake up, before you jump out of bed, you can take a breath, a couple breaths. You know, it's a beautiful reflection. Waking up this morning, I smile. It's the first thing you could do in the day. It will shift the way you go through the day, just to consciously realize, I woke up today. That wasn't guaranteed that I would get another day to live. But here I am. Smile at that. I'm alive. Waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are all for me. I have 24 hours. I vow to live mindfully and to look at all beings with the eyes of compassion. Right? So that's a lot of wisdom in that little four lines, you know? So the gathas are helpful ways to pause throughout the day. So when you're brushing your teeth, you want to have this aspiration to speak lovingly, speak truthfully. Mm-hmm. When you sit down to eat, to take a breath before you eat, just really pause, look at the food. Mm-hmm. We really are on automatic pilot a lot of the time. So being intentional, just a moment of intention. Can I just be grateful for those who prepared this food? When you go to the bathroom, we think that, you know, the real final sacred practice is in the meditation hall. Well, the bathroom is as sacred as the meditation hall. Going to the toilet in mindfulness, that's possible. You can rest. So it's called the restroom for a reason. But don't you know, my habit energy is to get in and get out as soon as I can, and I create stress. But what if we just chose to relax for a moment and really let your body rest on the toilet seat? Talking to people. Before you pick up the phone or dial your cell phone to make a call, breathe 3 times. Get in touch with how you want to communicate with that person. One of the ways we invite people to take the practice home, we have the bell on retreat, but your phone can be a mindfulness bell. Instead of answering it right away, you could let it ring 3 times. Mm-hmm. And for those rings, you follow your breath. You're not just, it's ringing, I have to answer. You can take a pause. Use that to relax. So just to say, for all of us, for all of the different things we're struggling with, to build in these moments of awareness, it adds up. Because anytime we stop, we can get a little diagnostic. We check in with our bodies. We notice, oh my gosh, my shoulders are all the way up here by my ears. No wonder we have a headache at the end of the day, because so much tension is accumulating. But if in little moments we pause, we can let that release, let that go. So, with, depleted energy, dealing with family members who are unkind, taking care of anger, how do we not fall into it and also not deny it or suppress it? A very important place to start is to simply know what emotion is arising. Right? Oh, hello, anger. I see that you're here. So just acknowledging what is in the system. If it's with a family member, okay, irritation or hurt or frustration. So naming the emotion when it arises. Then once we've seen it, and is that what helps us to name it is to have mindfulness. And this is why we really encourage all of us to have a regular daily practice of some sort, whether it's sitting meditation, same time every day for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, walking meditation. You can choose one part of your path every day to walk mindfully. Maybe some kind of movement meditation, that might be your practice. But something that you do on a regular basis that helps you center, because once you're in an emotional storm, it's kind of late. They say don't dig a well when you're thirsty, right? So if you're practicing on a regular basis, when that storm hits, you have something with which to meet it. So that's that energy, it's a muscle, right? Every time we practice mindfulness, when we listen to a talk, when we come to a Dharma sharing with others, when we just are aware of our body, the moment, that's building up that muscle. So when anger arises, there's something else in us that has the ability to see anger. If we're not training our mindfulness, when anger arises, it just takes over the whole scene, and then we become anger. But if we have one part of ourself that's aware, oh, I'm getting angry. And often anger doesn't go from 0 to 10 immediately. There are little hints before it gets really strong. And we can get better and better at recognizing it earlier and earlier. Right? There's like something in the stomach. And then we start thinking about what happened. And then suddenly we're flushed in the face. And then we want to do something. Right? So there's like, and who is it that's building the anger? Our own thoughts, our own way of responding to it, right? That's what Maricela was talking about, the second, third, fourth arrows. So if we recognize, oh, here's anger, then right away we can avoid putting more wood on that fire, which is our habit to do if we're not aware that anger is there. We're consumed by the anger. So mindfulness is able to say, oh, here's anger. here's whatever emotion with the family member. Can I breathe with this? Breathing in, I know I'm angry. Breathing out, I'm here for my anger. So most of the time when we have a suffering emotion, we want to push it away. That is, you know, the earliest single cell organism moves away from something painful and unpleasant. So this is deeply rooted in our DNA. But it's possible to see our suffering not as an enemy inside of us, not as a monster, but as a crying baby, as a tender part of ourself that needs care. And when we can see it that way, we don't want to push it away. So anger can be held and embraced. So first we name it, we recognize it, then we accept that it's there. Okay? We want it to be gone, but in fact we can, that doesn't help us get through it. So mindfulness has the ability to say, oh, it's normal that you're here. This is a human emotion that everyone experiences. I welcome you. It's okay that you're here. So it's like there's a mother, a father, a parent, an older brother, an older sister there holding the anger. The anger has adult supervision. It's not left on its own to cause havoc. So something is there. If this is anger, the emotion of suffering, then this is mindfulness, holding, embracing with kindness this emotion. Saying, I got you. I'm here for you. It's okay that you're there. I will hold you, I'll embrace you. And immediately, when we turn towards our suffering with kindness, it starts to release, it starts to relax. Because anytime we meet a suffering with, I don't want you, you should go away, what happens?
It strengthens it.
It just gets stronger. It wants to be recognized, it wants to be seen, it's here, it's an energy, right? So if we can allow it to be there. It's, oh, okay, I don't have to fight to make myself known. I can be seen. And then as we embrace it, it begins to show itself to us. It begins to reveal. We begin to have insights into what's going on. Right? We may, like Marisela was saying, this overreactive immune response, we may realize, oh, this person reminds me of someone who hurt me in the past. This person actually hasn't done anything to me, and I'm... So as the anger comes, we begin to see beneath the first layer to the hurt, to the sadness, to the fear, right? And then we begin to be free of that, you know? And each time we embrace and hold our anger in that way, it shifts at the root of where it comes from. So the next time something triggering happens to us, we get less triggered. Our anger doesn't come up as strong, it doesn't come up as quickly, and it doesn't last as long. So that's why you'll see people who, even in the most difficult circumstances, injustice, real oppression, they don't go into anger. They hold that with some kind of balance. Not that they're passive, not that they don't do anything to protect themselves, but they're not a victim of anger. And they're very effective in responding to that situation. Because that's someone whose seed of anger in the depths of their consciousness is quite small. It's there, but it's not something they've been nourishing. On the other hand, you'll see people who get angry for nothing. Someone just looks at them funny, and they could jump on them. Mm-hmm. We know people like that, right? The seed of anger in their consciousness is huge because they've been doing things every day to nourish that seed of anger. So every time we embrace our anger with mindfulness, we're actually conditioning ourselves to be less reactive to anger. And it doesn't mean anger doesn't have a role, that anger isn't important. It exists for a reason. But it doesn't have to cause havoc.
Are you all tired? You need a break?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? think we'll close with, I'll try to respond to Natalie's question and Rhonda's together. So the neural imprinting, we're in the path of neural imprinting. Can we intervene and have control? So the practice, we know now there's more scientific data, and I'm not going to stay with the scientific data because you can go and Google that. But we do know that this continuous practice of mindfulness and meditation, there is change in, there's actual change in the brain. Right? So we know that this practice has physiological changes in the brain. And once we start physiologically changing the brain, we're now changing the function of the brain too. And that means everything that's happening there. We also know more and more that the neural imprinting, it's trained. It's an imprinting that's trained from patterns of consecutive behaviors, repetitive patterning behaviors, and that because it's trained, that means it can be untrained, and it can be trained to do something different. And so the practice of mindfulness and meditation is really just that, what Kari Jewel just mentioned about those daily speed bumps. That is that changing, that repatterning, that imprinting to do, to respond differently, to breathe, to relax the body. When you breathe, when we breathe, there's a physiological response that occurs. We're now shifting, we decrease the amount of cortisone. And I don't want to go into that, the physiology so much, but just to say that breathing actually triggers a relaxation response. A physiological relaxation response occurs when we take a deep breath. The body produces chemicals that's different than when we didn't take that deep breath. And that itself now shifts the whole relaxation way. Everything shifts down. The organs are going to function differently, relaxes. And that also impinges on the nervous system, that it's going to now respond differently. And if we keep doing, and the Buddha figured it out 2,500 years ago. Mm-hmm. Dr. Herbert Benson in Boston did research in the 70s that showed that the breath actually resulted in a physiological response. So, and that was in the 70s. And now we have gone even further to mapping the brain, MRIs of the brain, studies with monks who have been meditating for X number of months and X number of years, comparing to those who haven't, and other, not only monks, but lay people as well. So now we know that physiologically we can change, and this is awesome, y'all. We can change the actual physiology and therefore function of who we think we are, who we have believed ourselves to be. So when someone says, well, that's just, I'm just like that, that I do that because I'm just like that, y'all know that. We especially hear it from our elders. I hear it from my elders. That's not quite true. It's not true. That's what we're taught to believe, but it's not true. We can change, and it doesn't matter how old we are. We used to think that nerves didn't regenerate. When I went to medical school, they thought nerves didn't regenerate. That's a few years now. Sorry. That's a few, my God. I just did the math. That's over 18 years ago. It's different now. Nerves regenerate. We now know that we thought that you were too old to regenerate nerve cells and nerve fibers, but we do. And it's the same thing. It's part of that. So when, I don't want to lose sight of where you say, where in that path. And that, I don't know if we know yet. I certainly don't know. And the science part of it that I do know and understand, I think it's still a process of unraveling. If we were to say like X number of moments of mindfulness or sitting meditation results in an intervention or a change here, I don't think we know that yet. But you know what? In another 10 years, maybe we will it. We'll know that. Because there's all these great, great relationships now between the scientists and the meditation community that this exact thing is being studied. And because mindfulness has taken taken society by storm in a way, there's a lot of delving into like exactly what is this mindfulness and what is it doing with the body? How does it affect neural imprinting? And is there different, are different parts of the brain lighting up if someone practices mindfulness X number of hours a day versus someone who practices? It used to be they would just compare those who did none and those who did some. Now they're comparing those who do some, this number versus this number versus this number. So I think there's a lot in store for us. But as far as like the specificity of it, I think we're still figuring it out. I think the practice is that we see, I can speak for myself, right? 2.5 years in a monastery of practicing, hearing a bell every which way you turn. Initially, I was like, well, gosh, that's kind of annoying, isn't it? And yet, this breathing, this stopping and breathing, three breaths. Every time you hear a bell, you take three breaths. And I remember asking this Dharma teacher in Palm Village, who I had a lot of respect for because they had such stillness. I said, what are you doing different? And she said, I take four breaths instead of three. It sounds funny, right? Okay, it sounds funny. And this is getting at the quantitative specificity that we're talking about. So this could be like our little experiment right here. But I started doing that. You know, so whenever the bell would be invited or the clock, you know, the alarm chimes or anything, you stop. And everyone has to experience this. So you got to find a monster. Anyway. The bell is invited, the alarm bell chimes, you stop. Whatever you're doing, if you're eating, you're drinking, you're walking, you're talking, you stop. And you just breathe, you take three breaths in and out. I took four, because she took four. Not because I'm special, but I wanted to be still like her. And so I took four. And I think, you know, something happens for those four breaths. There's something happening, we're retraining, that's the retraining. We're changing that neural imprint. And I'll tell you now, sometimes when I'm still, I don't want to be still. Sometimes, you know, like I have some friends that they say to me, I want to slap you and get you to wake up sometimes because I'm not responding like I used to, especially in some of the crazy things that are happening now. And sometimes I say to her, you're right, I don't know. I kind of think I want to. But you know, I don't really want to, but there's something that's been physiologically trained and reshaped in me that allows me to be more still and to look at it. And I respond still. It's not in the way some of my friends want me to respond, honestly. And you lose friends. Sometimes tribe leaves you. And you know, it's okay. Because I think this is something that's really important. This is freedom. And then just to talk about the group dynamics within our POC spaces. So that's one of the reasons I left when I left in 06, was being in primarily a POC space of difficult work, and the gender roles, you know, the Black male leadership role, how much we as POC hold that up also, right? Mm-hmm. Like how much we keep putting that crown on the male head. We do it, you know, we do it. The gender identity and sexual identity role, the immigrant, like the immigrant stuff, you know, as an immigrant who's worked a lot in African-American low-income communities around housing issues, that was a hard one to take, you know? That was a real hard one to take. And it silenced me often. It silenced me because it wasn't about that struggle. You know, this is a housing struggle. This is gentrification, anti-displacement work. This is not an immigrant issue. And yet we can, we don't have to address all the issues in our, you know, in our political identity work. But what we have to do is we have to be respectful of every single one of them. And we don't do that. In most organizing spaces that I've been in Baltimore, and I've been doing organizing a long, long time, I've not met, I've not met an organizing or activist space where we are able to hold each of the isms with love and care, right? And I'm not talking about we need to go to everybody's protest. I'm not saying that, because that's impossible. I'm saying just the love and the respect across the whole matrix of oppression. We do not do that in our spaces of organizing for justice. And we don't have time that, you know, that's something that I'm working on in Baltimore now, is creating an organization that we've just started called Volar, Village of Love and Resistance. And it's a social justice space that's going to be grounded in love. And for us, what that means is that it comes out of love, which means that we don't have the bandwidth to discriminate against any of the isms, while our focus will be on solidarity, economics, and housing issues. We recognize everyone and all their issues. And we're creating this because we haven't found it in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. That's why we're creating it. So it's real, and I know it's everywhere. I know it's not just Baltimore, but I'm speaking to Baltimore. I know a little bit about DC. It's the same in DC. Thank you.
Thank you for the wonderful questions. Mm-hmm. We'll listen to a sound of the bell. Taking four breaths, I just take three. So 11:30, so should we just go into a